This program was recorded before the Sandinistas lost the elections of February 1990.
I sent over a paper to the State Department for their press rep, the Hiding Carter, you know, the guy that speaks out every day on world events, to read. And I had four paragraphs in it because the situation was changing that night. And I said, you know, with a note, call us before you go on the air in the morning, I'll tell you which paragraph to read. And they were all four totally false. And they, as a matter of fact, they called in the morning and I said, you know, paragraph three, and they read paragraph three and went with it, you know, which is utter complicity in putting out the propaganda, the disinformation.
So that was the CIA giving the information to the State Department to put out on our media.
Yeah. The CIA has salted its agents throughout the Congress, every committee. And it's done this, you know, it did it three decades ago. And we're seeing it once again, but it's standard. But we did have, in November of 75, we had the CIA director, Bill Colby, who had been putting out our propaganda line to the Senate, our lies, was tied up on a trip or something. And so Bill Nelson, the deputy director of operations, went over to stand in for him. And he said before he went, I'm not going to lie. And he just flat said it in a staff meeting. He said, I'm retiring in 3 weeks, and I'll be damned if I'm going to spend my retirement answering perjury charges. So he went over there and told the truth. Now, Ambassador Mulcahy said one thing, and then Nelson testified and said exactly the opposite. And so they had a direct head-to-head contradiction. And so the senators nailed Mulcahy. One of you gentlemen is lying. And so Mulcahy asked for the opportunity to speak again, in which he clarified his statements and told the truth. But the interesting thing was that that testimony refuted everything else we'd been saying for 3 months. They did not investigate and follow up on it and indict, especially Bill Colby, for perjury, which they could have on the basis of that. They just let it, you know, let it go. There was no follow-up to it.
The CIA lies and manipulation of the press. The CIA penetration of Congress, congressional cover-ups, mass media cover-ups. These are some of the subjects we'll feature tonight with John Stockwell, former CIA official, and with a documentary highlighting the subjects. Tonight on Alternative Views. Program was recorded the 10th of June, 1987.
Welcome back to Alternative Views. The centerpiece of tonight's program will be a special documentary about the CIA and the mass media. We've talked about this a lot of times on Alternative Views, particularly with John Stockwell, who was with the CIA for 13 years. And John, you appear in this documentary about the media and the CIA. How did this documentary come to be made?
I was passing through London on my way to Vietnam and called a friend at Diverse Productions. Actually called them from the States before we, you know, got to London. And they had some ideas and researched it before I got there. But what makes it work so good is, you know, who has actually run Western or United States disinformation campaigns, you know. Who can say, here's how it's done, here's how we did it, with proof, the articles in the paper of our results.
The emphasis of this documentary is about the CIA and the media, but there's a larger framework in this too, which we've talked about in our program from time to time, and that is the overall lying of the State Department, the White House, is this a coordinated thing, or do all these organizations just do their lying separately and it adds up to one big falsehood?
Read Noam Chomsky's Turning the Tide to get a feeling for the way our, you know, it's what they call the establishment in the 60s, the way they are committed, the elites that run the country, which includes the State Department and the CIA and presidents and politicians. They have a charter, you know, to run the country in their interests. And this means that they not exactly lockstep, but they just presume to have the right to mislead people. It's part of the way the United States is, and God knows most other countries as well. They are not bound by honesty and integrity. Watching these hearings before Congress now, you really get this. I mean, what is the point, as the senators were asking of Elliot Abrams? You know, what is the point of asking you any questions at all? Because you're going to lie. And Abrams is, you know, is just lying. Well, what's the point of asking the CIA anything in hearings? Their whole ethic is they're doing illegal things, and they're, you know, they teach you from the first day in training cover stories, and you practice them at length, and the director practices them, and when he briefs the Congress, he does the cover stories. White House staffers are not trained professionally, but there it's in the ethics of politics, ethics of the business. They're putting out a myth about the world, a myth about the United States nature. Chomsky notes that the compelling force, the ethic against which all foreign policy decisions are made, is defense of the fifth freedom. You know, the four freedoms were Roosevelt and Churchill in January of 41. We were fighting the war for the freedom of speech, freedom of religion, freedom from want, freedom from fear. And the fifth freedom is what, you know, has compelled our actions in reality then and ever since. And that's the United States' freedom to rob, exploit, and kill. And every, you know, every situation is measured by our right, our imperial right. It's not a divine right, but our imperial right. Any country that tries to break away from this control, like Vietnam, either you bring them back in or you destroy them so much that they won't be an example to anyone else. And this is what's happening in Nicaragua. They want to bring it back in by ousting the Sandinistas. Failing that, they want to crush the country, so it can't be an example to anyone. Cuba, they haven't quite succeeded either way, but so they just try to discredit it.
In relationship to the lying and the coordination, and of course, John was on either the National Security Council or a subcommittee of the National Security
Council. I was working for a subcommittee of the National Security
during the Angolan operation. Yeah. So there is one area where different people from different parts of the executive branch meet, and then, of course, they meet in cabinet meetings. Were media strategies and lying discussed ever at these meetings?
For sure. Oh, yeah, for sure.
So there is some coordination as well as it being a consensus of how things are really going.
One example I cite in my In Search of Enemies book is one day I sent over, you know, I was doing it, but you know, under their supervision, I sent over a paper to the State Department for their press rep, the Hiding Carter, you know, the guy that speaks out every day on world events, to read. And I had four paragraphs in it because the situation was changing that night. And I said, you know, with a note, call us before you go on the air in the morning, I'll tell you which paragraph to read. And they were all four totally false. And they, as a matter of fact, they called in the morning and I said, you know, paragraph three, and they read paragraph three and went with it, you know, which is utter complicity in putting out the propaganda, the disinformation.
So that was the CIA giving the information to the State Department to put out on our media.
Yeah.
Yet there's a contradiction here. Some people like Elliot Abrams get caught lying, they get in trouble, and it's even possible their whole careers can be broken. Did you ever discuss the dilemmas of lying and the schizophrenia? On one hand, you're supposed to be telling the truth. On the other hand, you're systematically lying. Did those kinds of issues ever come up?
There's a little bit of that. Basically, you know, the congressmen and senators are not holier than thou when it comes to lying, because they do the same thing all the time. But still, it is perjury. I mean, when a senator makes a false statement in speeches before, that's not perjury, that's the debate in them. But when you're in another branch of the government and you're called before a committee and you lie, technically you could go to jail. Right. And Dick Helms, the CIA director, was indicted for lying about the Chilean thing. And then, you know, given a plea bargain sentence, so they didn't pursue it. But we did have, in November of 75, we had the CIA director, Bill Colby, who had been putting out our propaganda line to the Senate, our lies, was tied up on a trip or something. And so Bill Nelson, the deputy director of operations, went over to stand in for him. And he said before he went, I'm not going to lie. And he just flat said it in a staff meeting. He said, I'm retiring in 3 weeks, and I'll be damned if I'm going to spend my retirement answering perjury charges. So he went over there and told the truth. Now, Ambassador Mulcahy said one thing, and then Nelson testified and said exactly the opposite. And so they had a direct head-to-head contradiction. And so the senators nailed Mulcahy. One of you gentlemen is lying. And so Mulcahy asked for the opportunity to speak again, in which he clarified his statements and told the truth. But the interesting thing was that that testimony refuted everything else we had been saying for 3 months. They did not investigate and follow up on it and indict, especially Bill Colby, for perjury, which they could have on the basis of that. They just let it go. There was no follow-up to it.
Well, we've talked a lot about lies and disinformation. And information, let's see the documentary about the CIA and how it manipulates the mass media.
After a night of fighting, Bruce Harbaugh wanted to build a conspiracy at least 40 dying in the land. The government attacked by Harbaugh and his family, Protestant housing estate in Portugal, very much to the
On Diverse Reports, we try to bring you background to the news you read in newspapers and see on television. Tonight, how much can we believe about the enemies of the United States? In Angola 10 years ago, and in Nicaragua today, we hear accounts of communist expansion. But are such stories true? Tonight, two former CIA officers tell reporter Christopher Hurd how lies invented about Angola and Nicaragua found their way into the world's press. Two experienced journalists tell him the difficulties they've had telling fact from fiction. Some people call this process disinformation, others call it lying. The CIA just call it a standard technique.
The Sandinista dictatorship of Nicaragua, with full Cuban Soviet bloc support, not only persecutes its people, the church, and denies a free press, but arms and provides bases for communist terrorists attacking neighboring states.
As they, you know, the saying that they have is that this has been said publicly, by the way, by a U.S. government spokesman, that our intelligence from Nicaragua is so good, you know, that we can hear the toilets flush in Managua. And I've often thought that might be the source of some of this information.
Angola, a country at war, rich in natural resources, as large as France and Spain together, a left-wing government supported by the Cubans fights a continual battle against a guerrilla army backed by the South Africans. 10 years ago, the Russians and their allies sent troops and guns into a continent where they had no right to be. According to the newspapers at the time, that's how the Angolan war started. Or did it? John Stockwell worked for the CIA for 12 years rising to the rank of colonel. His last assignment was to run America's secret campaign in Angola.
We had set ourselves well above and beyond the law, beyond the Congress, beyond the Constitution. We were lying to the President, lying to the Secretary of State, lying to the Congress about what we were doing.
1974, the Portuguese Revolution. The end of centuries of dictatorship and oppression at home and of Portuguese imperialism in Africa. But as the colonies gain independence, in the largest, Angola, three groups vied for control of one of the richest countries in Africa. Jonas Savimbi, a friend of Che Guevara, but now an anti-Marxist, led UNITA. Agostinho Neto, a Western-educated left-winger, led the MPLA. Holden Roberto led the FNLA. He had been on the payroll of the CIA for 14 years, so he was the obvious choice for the seasoned campaigners back in Washington.
The CIA had just closed down three long-term paramilitary operations in Southeast Asia. Vietnam, Cambodia, and Laos. They had over 1,000 paramilitary case officers come flocking back to Washington. They didn't have desks for everybody, much less jobs, and morale was rock bottom low. They wanted a covert action. They wanted a paramilitary encounter. Angola was convenient. There never was a study done of who's who in Angola, who would be best for Angola, who would be best for the CIA or for the United States, or why. There was no study done. Well, the rationale was that the Soviet Union was trying to take advantage of the United States' weakness right after the Vietnam War, that Angola was getting its independence and they were trying to snap it up, and that Henry Kissinger decided that we could not be weak and we wouldn't let them do it. Our own files disproved that. We moved into Angola first and the Russians were responding to us.
But before the CIA could start a war on the other side of the world, in Angola, it needed the approval of the National Security Council, a key part of the American decision-making machine, where policy is made by the top men in the government and the military.
The first briefings on Angola literally went, gentlemen, this is a map of Africa. Here is Angola. And then they went on with a chart to explain their three liberation movements in Angola. One of them is headed by Holden Roberto. He's the good guy. We've worked with him for years, and they use literally good guy. Then the MPLA is headed by this drunken, psychotic Marxist poet, Agostinho Neto. He's the bad guy. And they used exactly to make sure that people understood. And then, you know, like I say, you pack off and go off to the, and they come in for the next briefing about Micronesia or somewhere. The superficiality of what I saw fat old men dozing off in subcommittee meetings of the National Security Council, in which we were making decisions that were getting people killed. And I mean exactly the way students do in their 9 o'clock class, you know, propping themselves up and getting their glasses balanced so it won't look, you know, people can't tell if they're in, and their heads nodding off. And then you'd have to wake them up sort of to get their concurrence on, so I explain something to them again.
But the newspapers contained nothing about the fascinating way in which policy was made. Instead, they fell victim to Stockwell's worldwide campaign of disinformation.
The basic theme was to make it look like a Russian-Cuban aggression in Angola. And so any kind of story that you could write and get into the media anywhere that pushed that line, you did. One-third of my staff in this task force was covert action, was propagandists, whose professional career jobs was making up stories and finding ways to get them into the press.
From the CIA's headquarters, Stockwell put his propagandists into London, Lisbon, Lusaka, and Kinshasa. From the safety of such cities, none of which are actually in Angola, they wrote press releases for the FNLA and UNITA, which were fed into the ticker tapes of the Western media. The propagandists assiduously courted Western journalists, briefing them and wining and dining them. His man in Lusaka was particularly enthusiastic.
He ran a story that the city of Malanje had been captured by the UNITA forces, and in doing so had captured 20 Russian advisors. And they thought this would show that Russians were running the thing in Angola. There weren't Russian advisors, it wasn't a factor, and we knew that.
So I went to the British Museum's newspaper library to see how successful Stockwell had been. And here's the story in The Guardian under the headline, UNITA captures 20 Russians. The UNITA statement, with all its convincing detail, is quoted at length. And according to this, there were 500 Russians and other mercenaries involved in the battle. And there were two tanks and three armored cars, and even a house full of arms of Russian make. The Guardian put quotes around the headline to show they weren't quite sure of the story, and presumably that's why they put a question mark after this hopeful little piece. The Melange story also made it to the front page of The Times, which quotes UNITA's claim that they captured 20 Russians in the battle for Melange. The Times clearly believed UNITA because they helpfully tell us that Melange used to be under the control of the MPLA. The source for this story was the Reuters correspondent in Lusaka.
I remember reporting that very clearly, and I should stress I was not the only journalist to report it. Many of us reported it, and we pinned it on an official UNITA communique. Years later I discovered that a little CIA misinformation expert had sat in the US embassy in Lusaka and had composed that communique. And it bore absolutely no relationship at all to truth.
When you reported it, did you think it was true?
I had absolutely no idea. I mean, you've got to remember, at that stage, during a war, you're working under incredible pressure. I worked for 4 months without a day off for 16 hours a day. And all that was wanted was a flow of information. I mean, I'd done the same in the Middle East War. I was based in Damascus. And in the first week of the war in Damascus, I wiped out the Israeli Air Force three times over with official statements.
Reuters is one of the world's largest news agencies. Its offices around the globe provide many papers with their only source of news from some parts of the world. Many papers actually rely on the same person for their information, the Reuters correspondent.
Well, I mean, with hindsight, some of the official statements from the side I was reporting, and I stress from the side I was reporting, but also from the side that people in Luanda with the MPLA were reporting, clearly most of those statements were completely false.
Most of them were completely false.
I would think so, yes.
Doesn't that mean that for the average reader we received an absolutely impossibly distorted view of what was going on?
I think that's a very fair assessment.
But newspapers were hungry for stories, and one of Stockwell's propagandists fed them well.
So he came up with another story, which he in fact kept going for weeks, and it was a good story in terms of the CIA's propaganda interests. He had some Cuban soldiers raping some young Angolan girls. Then there was a battle, and he had that Cuban unit cut off and captured. And then he had the Cuban women, the victims, identifying their rapists. And then there was a trial, and they were convicted. And then he had them executed by a firing squad of the women who had supposedly been violated, with photographs of young African women with weapons shooting down these Cubans. There had never been a rape. There had never been the military action. The Cubans had never been captured. It was all fiction.
Stockwell did extremely well with this story. Here's the Daily Express of March the 12th, 1976. Gun girls execute Cuban rapists is the headline. And quoting from UNITA, it says that 17 Cubans were executed, five of whom had been identified as the people who had raped four African women a few weeks before. And here's the Evening Standard with a bit more convincing detail, saying the Cubans were shot with their own guns. And here's the Daily Telegraph, the newspaper of record, adding a bit more detail, identifying the region from which the women came and saying that they took part in the executions. The reporter was John Bullock.
I haven't the faintest idea whether it was true, and I never said it was true. I reported somebody as saying that, as telling me that story. I certainly didn't report the facts. I reported Mr. A or sources from such and such a group as saying that. I don't know whether it was true. If you don't publish it, maybe it is true. You get, I should have thought, worse criticism for not publishing it than for publishing it. Because when you publish it, you do attribute it quite clearly and firmly to a man, a person who's saying so. If you don't publish it, you're already making a judgment. You're deciding it's not true. It's not our job to decide.
editors are not going, and in most Western newspapers, are not going to be too skeptical of a Cuban rapist story. It sort of fits the general Western line and what the West wants to read about Cuba and whatnot. The truth is, all of the information we were getting was that the Cubans were handling themselves brilliantly and very generously towards the Africans.
Basically, and to put it very crudely, you can publish any old crap you like, and it will get newspaper room.
Despite the CIA's best efforts, the armies they supported never stood much of a chance once Cuban soldiers arrived in the autumn of 1975 to help the MPLA. Holden Roberto's FNLA and his CIA mercenaries were wiped out. UNITA and the South Africans beat a hasty retreat. Back in Washington, Congress didn't want another Vietnam and stopped Kissinger from spending any more money in Angola. Interestingly, some American multinationals operating in the country had always supported the MPLA. But when the corporations expressed their views to the American government, they were treated as the enemy.
When we went in, Gulf Oil was pumping the Angolan oil. We forced Gulf to stop. And the way we did this was by Henry Kissinger placing some phone calls and saying that he would open an investigation of international bribery by Gulf Oil Company. The fighting was effectively over in about February of 76. The Congress stopped us then and forced us to withdraw. By early March, within about 3 weeks, Gulf Oil was back with U.S. technicians in Cabinda pumping the Angolan oil, with Cuban soldiers protecting them from CIA mercenaries who were still mucking around in northern Angola. Now, years later, Western corporations are doing business great with Angola. David Rockefeller, Gulf, Boeing, Texaco is building a refinery there, De Beers, you know, working with the diamonds. They all lobby in Washington saying they have no problem doing business with the government of Angola.
But the war still goes on, with the South Africans financing UNITA. The Americans have turned their attention elsewhere, to Nicaragua. Unlike Angola, this is a country which any journalist can visit, so America's lies can be discovered more easily. But these have still dominated the papers. First, there was the arms flow story. According to Reagan, Nicaragua supplied guns to the left-wing guerrillas in neighboring El Salvador. David McMichael was the CIA's senior analyst on Nicaragua. They asked him to write a report on the arms flow. But when he looked at the evidence, it didn't support Reagan's claims.
The argument that we're dealing with here is, do these arms come through or from Nicaragua with the complicity of the Nicaraguan government? And the evidence does not sustain that.
Undeterred, the American government continues to insist that Nicaragua is a center of international communist terrorism. According to Reagan, it harbors members of the IRA, the Red Brigades, the Baader-Meinhof gang, and Basque separatists. So the American government has poured money into supporting the opponents of the Nicaraguan regime.
We have an obligation to be of help where we can to freedom fighters, lovers of freedom and democracy, from Afghanistan to Nicaragua.
The freedom fighters he is talking about are called the Contras.
Well, they wouldn't exist without the CIA. They wouldn't. They simply would not exist as a viable force. The Contras never even received money themselves to buy arms. That was all handled for them by the CIA. And there's no way out of saying that the Contra force is essentially and almost entirely a creation of the United States government. The Contras are agents of the United States government.
Since we have been there, since the very end of 1981 until now, has been a constant escalation of the war into our area. and there's been a great deal of real terrorism going on in the area. We have mass kidnappings. We've had whole villages that have been swept down on, and they take everyone, women, children, men, animals, everything that moves. We have had rapes and kidnappings, torture, murder, about everything that one could imagine that could happen in a war. And this has been carried out by the Contra.
That is, a standard technique in, in attempting to destabilize and overthrow a government, is to demonstrate to the citizens of that government, to the citizens, that its government cannot provide security for them. And this is the way to break resistance. And this is what they do. This is the famous CIA manual. Takayan, laid this out very clearly for them. I hate to say it in this cold-blooded way, but it is a standard technique.
To help, the CIA has produced a Freedom Fighters Manual. This shows how to make Molotov cocktails, how to throw them, and who to throw them at. It gives helpful advice on disrupting transport and communications and destroying property. Other standard techniques are aimed at people.
I'm very embarrassed by the United States support for the Contra, and I think it is illegal and immoral. They don't call Ronald Reagan Ronald, they call him Donald Reagan, which is a play on the word to donation, because everything they have is from him.
They are our brothers, these freedom fighters, and we owe them our help. They are the moral equal of our founding fathers and the brave men and women of the French Resistance. We cannot turn away from them.
Well, brothers, I suppose, brothers and sisters, we all are of the same God in that sense. Certainly, I wouldn't classify them as freedom fighters or as the moral equivalent of our founding fathers in the United States.
In 1981, the CIA asked McMichael for a report on the Nicaraguan press, opposition parties, and church.
And my conclusion was that, there was a significant space for these groups to operate, but that they were in no danger of suppression or disappearance. Compared to any other Central American country, Nicaragua has by far the liveliest opposition press and media. Over two-thirds, for example, of the 40-odd radio stations in the country are still privately owned and generally speak their mind.
When McMichael spoke his mind, the CIA didn't like it. He was sacked.
The Sandinista dictatorship of Nicaragua, with full Cuban Soviet bloc support, not only persecutes its people, the church, and denies a free press, but arms and provides bases for communist terrorists attacking neighboring states.
I certainly don't recognize any of the diatribes that have been made against the Sandinistas as to the persecution of the church, persecution of peoples, the denial of human rights. That is not in my experience.
After 4 years of fighting the Americans, the Nicaraguan government has now suspended most civil rights. In the world's newsrooms, they are more inclined to listen to the President of America than to the President of Nicaragua. So in the propaganda battle, the CIA's inventions still hit the front page. In 1982, they produced convincing evidence of Soviet bases in Nicaragua.
I used to laugh and say, look at that Soviet-style baseball diamond over there. This is almost foolish, really, to talk about this. First of all, they're not Soviet military bases. That's the whole point. The second is that a barracks is a barracks. An obstacle course is an obstacle course.
How about this for a story? Just under a year ago, the Americans discovered a Soviet freighter carrying MiG fighter planes, which they said were on their way to Nicaragua. Here's the story on the front of the Times. Moscow warned on Nicaraguan MiGs, and there's a picture of a MiG-21. According to President Reagan, this showed that Nicaragua was a threat to the United States.
And as it turned out, this was the evidence for this was based on satellite photography, which showed crates an East European port facility, which were determined to be, in the science of cratology, the crates of the sort in which MiG aircraft frequently were shipped. And subsequent photographs a day or two later showed that these crates had were no longer on the dock. And an amazing leap of logic, it was advanced that necessarily they must have been delivered to Nicaragua, or were on their way to be delivered to Nicaragua. Well, it's the usual thing. The charge makes the headlines. The retraction makes the inside pages. 8 or 10 days later, it's revealed, well, MiGs weren't on the way, but that's no longer a headline. So what one is left with is the overall impression from the screaming headlines of the week earlier that Nicaragua continues to represent this enormous danger to the security of the United States, this nation of 3 million impoverished souls, half of whom are under the age of 15, you know.
Well, I would say people are very silly if they believe everything that newspapers tell them, and I think probably anybody who buys a newspaper needs a course on how to read newspapers.
Part of my reason for coming out of the CIA is that it was a tragedy, a travesty of U.S. principles of freedom and democracy, that you would have the United States setting up a tradition of supporting dictatorships, brutal ones, forming and training their brutal police and death squads, while the Soviet Union, which has had periods of pretty harsh policies towards its own people, is winding up the champion of real freedom throughout the world. If you have a dictator and you want some help getting rid of him, you cannot go to the United States. You can go to the Soviet Union.
People in the foreign policy establishment, let us put it this way, and I believe this is not only true of my own country but many others, you know, believe that in the interest of national policy that it is legitimate to lie. They do not feel it is dishonorable to lie, and when they do lie well, they expect to be rewarded for it.
Now let's return with our interview with John Stockwell, who was in the CIA for 13 years, quit the agency, and wrote his famous book, In Search of Enemies. We shift our focus now to the lying and cover-ups of the Contragate situation as of the 10th of June, 1987.
I think we're dealing here with a modified, limited hangout, you know. They are hanging some stuff out for public consumption, but they're not asking the really tough questions. And I think the effect is going to be a cover-up of the dimensions of second only to the Warren Commission's cover-up of the Kennedy assassination, just because they're not pressing the hard questions. They're allowing people to gloss over, even the ones who are telling the truth, the painful truth. They're being loved upon so much by the senators, you know, that there's no sting in it, and they're being permitted to advocate their cause, and they're being complimented for fighting communism and everything. I mean, this Felix Rodriguez, for example, when he was on the stand, now this man has been jailed in Venezuela for arranging the bombing of a passenger plane. And then he's brought into the Oliver North network, right, and everything, and this guy's testifying. Yeah, and you have plots in Central America to kill the U.S. ambassador, which people in the same network have testified to before the press, have given official statements to that effect. There should be some tougher questions asked about these things. And instead, they're lauding these people for their patriotism.
And they're not even talking about the drug running and the whole drug operation.
And they're not touching on the drug running. Calero's on the stand. You have two or three Contra leaders indicted inside the United States, caught with cocaine, and nobody asked Calero if he knew them. Were they working for you? Were they Contras? Did you know them? Did you pay their plane tickets? Who did pay their plane tickets? Did they have contact with the CIA? Did you get a cut? I mean, these are all, you know, legitimate questions, which are not being asked.
Well, Daniel, in a way, asked Calero in the final questions if he'd heard the stories about the Contras running drugs and if he himself was involved in the drug-running operations. And Calero said, yes, he heard the stories, but they were lies, and no, he'd never had anything to do with drugs. And then, in a way, dropped it.
Yeah,
and that was the end of
that's
testimony.
See, they get it on the record, and he denies it, and in a way, dropped it. And see, right. That's the touch that they're using in this thing. So to cover themselves, yes, we asked that question. But they didn't ask it the way a Senate committee would ask it, right. if they were trying to get to the bottom of it. And what about this? And what about this individual? Now, in fact, you know this individual. Now, this man is, you know, caught in San Francisco with 40 pounds of cocaine. You know, and he was, in fact, associated with you. Are you denying that you knew him? And, you know, remind him, you're under oath, you know. If you deny that you knew him and we find that you did, you know. I mean, they're just glossing over this stuff. Well, the heavy questions.
Now, you have had some success and some non-success in getting information into the establishment media, New York Times and the L.A. Times. Can you tell us about this?
You mean me in my present incarnation recently, yeah. I was also successful 10 years ago in getting disinformation. I have gotten a New York Times op-ed and a Los Angeles Times op-ed, mostly focusing on Oliver North. And you know, just initially, the Oliver North Network and the activities. But I've since been circulating a draft of a piece that's asking why the questions are not being asked by the Senate, by the investigators. And the New York Times, I'll give them credit, they kept it for 2 weeks. I mean, assassinations of world leaders.
And drugs.
And drug running, for example. And the bombing of for example, Secord selling material to the Contras. You know, General Secord, did you sell any C4 plastique to the Contras? Is a legitimate question, because this is what was used to blow up an American journalist, you know, and a couple of dozen other people in La Penca, Nicaragua. And so that's a legitimate question. Did you sell them any C4? Are you aware of any C4 being sold to them? These questions not being asked. The New York Times kept it for 2 weeks, and they definitely had some editors who wanted to run it. It's a very forceful piece. And eventually the others prevailed, and I had no idea of who the personalities were one way or the other.
Was it the bosses that didn't like it and the underlings did, or?
Well, clearly somebody with authority must have been against it, because they didn't run it. If it had been the bosses who favored it, it would have run eventually, a hierarchy being as it is. But the fact that they agonized about it for 2 weeks, and there was some dissension, you know, there are people in there who would like to see the questions asked. And I was explaining, if the media won't ask the questions, you know, what hope is there that the politicians will? And I was getting very sympathetic responses, but the piece didn't run. And then I called it into the Los Angeles Times this afternoon and talked to one of the editors in the op-ed page there, and I got yelled at. I got berated.
Oh,
indeed. He called me a 60s radical, the worst kind of 60s radical thinking, trying to build a case out of poppycock. Oh, yeah, he was going on and allowed, I don't have to put up with this from someone like you, he said. And I was saying, wait a minute, you know, this is me. And during the 60s, I pointed out to him the 60s radicalism, you know, I was inside doing these things and getting medals for it. And he just glossed over that. At one point, he was throwing out such spacious arguments that I just told him, I said, that's inane.
Like, what did he say?
Well, he said, when I was listing the world leaders that have been killed, in some cases are targeted by the Reagan administration. The White House has admitted one, two others there's evidence, and then there's several others, and I was running through these briefly. And he said, my father died of a heart attack. Why don't you throw him in? And I said, what does that have to do with Reagan and political assassinations? Was he a world leader opposed to the Reagan doctrine? He said, well, you seem to be trying to throw in everything else in the world. Everybody that's ever died, he said. And I said, you know, that's inane.
Well, he ran your stuff before.
Why he ran my stuff
why
before.
Why is this flip-flop?
Well, I had been warned that he individually was very temperamental.
Oh.
And when I talked to him the previous time, he was so cordial and easy to work with that I presumed there was just some kind of misunderstanding. And this time I met the testy, temperamental editor.
And I think there's something else. We did a report that the Los Angeles Times has been more critical of Reagan's foreign policy, in particular the Central American policy, than the New York Times or the Washington Post. But when it comes to a more fundamental critique of U.S. policy, such as the policy of carrying out political assassinations, that goes beyond their tolerance point. I think they just won't accept.
And yet you have the White House staffers admitting that the bombing of Libya, they were targeting Gaddafi. You have 70, as Cy Hirsch put it in his New York Times Magazine piece on the 22nd of February, 70 Air Force officials and White House staffers admitted to him that they were targeting Gaddafi himself. They call it leadership targeting. If you read the article, there's even a memo he cites the CIA had written to the White House that said that if they could succeed in killing Gaddafi's family, it would emasculate him because Bedouin's supposed to be able to protect his family. So you even have the suggestion of killing his family. Then Sy got the information. They had intelligence 45 minutes before the bombs landed that Gaddafi was at home. And they bombed that point. And he had left since then, apparently. And they did kill his daughter instead. Now, even with admissions like that coming out, plus the other two cases of evidence, the editor of the LA Times, his answer to that was, he was saying, come on now, we bombed a capital. You know, you're calling that an assassination. I'm saying, wait a minute, the major media has reported
policy to hit Gaddafi. That was the target.
Even George Shultz said that.
Even George Shultz said that, and yet the editor of the LA Times was giving me the White House party line. It was bombing a capital.
They've admitted that there's been a series of attempts to assassinate Fidel Castro over the years, and there's been accusations that the U.S. Was involved in the assassination of Lumumba in the Congo in the 1960s. You yourself were active in that area during that period.
Senate investigators brought it out, and it was openly reported. So you have
him in Vietnam.
You have a situation where the White House, the Oliver North Network, the Reagan National Security operatives have been playing hardball, admitting it, bragging about it. Yeah, we were out to kill the bastard, they say about Gaddafi, and yet the Congress won't ask the questions that would be natural to follow up on such statements, and the media won't publish the article saying, you know, on X date, this staffer said, blah. Therefore, why aren't we asking? Why aren't we probing? No, it's too unsavory.
John, we've seen in the past and also in the present with this present thing going on in Congress that they have ex-CIA people as members of the staffs, congressional staffs, and liaison people with these congressional staffs and the various government agencies. How it looks to me like it's carefully controlled, if not contrived. But this looks like this is a usual thing for the CIA, either present or past operatives and personnel, to link up with key congressional committees that are involved with CIA activities.
Being less than dumb, the CIA has salted its agents throughout the Congress, every committee. And it's done this, you know, it did it three decades ago. And we're seeing it once again, but it's standard. For example, when I testified to the Senate Oversight Committee in 77, when my letter came out and, you know, the book following, and hearings not dramatic like these, but nevertheless on the same subject of perjury and cover-up and law-breaking by the National Security Council and the CIA, they guaranteed the Senate, Gary Hart, guaranteed me protection, that the CIA would never know the source of this information. And Gary Hart personally, you know, has said that, I was skeptical. I said, there's no way you can protect me for speaking out. And he made a kind of a pious speech and said, you know, if we can't protect our sources from these guys, what chance do we have of ever getting into the truth of these matters? So I testified at length. I took his word for it. And I testified at length And then I flew down here to Texas to check my notes to get some more information on Friday, to fly back on Sunday to testify again on Monday. And when I got up there on Monday, they had already transcribed and sent to the CIA my testimony. And so just, you know, for spite, I bearded them. I mean, I knew that the CIA would get this testimony, but nevertheless, I said, you gave me your word. You absolutely guaranteed, Bill Miller was the chief staffer, and Gary Hart, you gave me your word you would protect me, and you made an issue out of it, and then without even clearing it with me, you sent my testimony to the CIA. And their answer was, well, come on, in truth, we can't get into something like this without making them aware of it, in addition to which they already had copies, as I'm sure you knew well. Now, two people sitting on the committee staff in the hearings were former colleagues of mine, at that point working full-time for the Senate Oversight Committee staff.
And no doubt leaking the documents back.
Open plants, right, on the innermost committee. This symbiotic relationship, you know, it's called the old boy thing, it's called the establishment. Now, of course, the classic case is this Tom Pulgar, who's been brought in to help the Congress organize the investigation of the Iran-Amok scandal. This is the chief of station from Saigon, who is responsible for the great debacle of the evacuation.
He was the one you told us about in a previous program, who gave a top-secret American information weekly to the North Vietnamese.
Yeah, to the Hungarians who were delivering it to the North Vietnamese, and thwarted our efforts to plan for an effective, orderly withdrawal, and honored CIA agents who had dumped their Vietnamese employees, and intervened up country to save the Hungarian communists who were in upcountry posts, who were no danger, but to fly them out courtesy of the CIA, and who, while he was keeping us from getting our people out, got his own personal household effects out safely early. While he was telling us there wasn't going to be an evacuation, he packed up his own personal stuff and got it out.
And now he's liaison man. What exactly is his function in this committee?
I don't know exactly how, but it's been published that he's been brought in to help them in investigation.
Yeah.
And mind you, this is a very, very senior CIA official, now retired. And so he would not be a clerk.
And he would obviously be leaking back to the CIA whatever he thought they'd want to know that Congress was investigating.
And also having lunch and breakfast with the senators and guiding their thoughts with suggestions and national
leading them
security.
Away from certain sensitive CIA operations.
Using his influence.
Well, let's face it, there aren't too many senators and congressmen that are overly bright and informed, so they rely on these people.
Yeah.
And they're completely ignoring the Christic Institute case in Miami, where they have all this information and they're laying it out.
Yeah, the Christic Institute thing is, I talked to Anthony Lewis about it, and he wouldn't respond with interest.
He's New York Times, right?
Yeah, now, he's perhaps the most liberal or the closest to a progressive of any major columnist, and I couldn't get any response from him on that. Now, as we've said before, the Christic Institute invites some criticism because a lot of stuff they're putting out in that affidavit is not accurate. And when we've documented that for them, myself, Frank Snepp, and Ralph McGeehee, who were there in Vietnam and said this is clearly not wrong, instead of cleaning it up...
Not correct.
Instead of cleaning it up, they have reprinted the thing and then continued mailing it out, and Danny Brandt and others, you know, checking them out on errors. And but see, that's not why the major media is boycotting the Christic thing. The major media is not willing to cut loose or disassociate from Secord and Shackley and crew, and that's, you know, when it gets right down to it, someone who's attacking them, those individuals, is attacking the establishment of which the major media is apparently part, because they will not join in even basic publicity for a lawsuit that's exposing these people. They're boycotting it because it's striking too close to the heart of the establishment itself.
I've been waiting for something. something to happen for a week or a month or a year, with the blood in the ink of the headlines and the sound of the crowd in my ear. You might ask what it takes to remember when you know that you've seen it before, where a government lies to a people and a country is drifting to war. And there's a shadow on the faces of the men who sent the guns to the wars that are fought in places where their business interest runs. On the radio, talk shows, and the TV, you hear one thing again and again: how the USA stands for freedom, and we come to the aid of a friend. But who are the ones that we call our friends? These governments killing their own, or the people who finally can't take anymore, and they pick up a gun, or a brick, or a stone. And there are lies in the balance.
Basically, and to put it very crudely, you can publish any old crap you like, and it will get newspaper room. I would say people are very silly if they believe everything that newspapers tell them, and I think probably anybody who buys a newspaper needs a course on how to read newspapers.
People in the foreign policy establishment, let us put it this way, and I believe this is not only true of my own country, but many others, you know,